Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Sam Evans Brown, and this is The Exchange. People have been eating oysters harvested from New Hampshire's Great Bay since the glaciers melted and the last ice age ended. For most of that history, oysters in the bay were abundant and healthy, but the populations of natural oyster reefs have plummeted thanks to overharvesting and more recently an influx of disease and bad water quality. Shellfish farming, however, is on the rise. There are now more than a dozen oyster aquaculture companies operating in the Great Bay, bringing fresh local seafood to ice-lined platters all over the Granite State. Meanwhile, efforts to restore the estuary's natural oyster reefs have been underway for more than a decade, with restaurants donating clam and oyster shells to be dumped back into the water. Today on the show, we're talking about the powerful potential of these bivalves to clean up the water of New Hampshire's hidden coast. And we want to hear from you. Email us to exchange@nhpr.org or call us at 1-800-892-6477. Joining me for the show today is Laura Brown, a oyster aquaculturist herself of Fox Point Oysters, which operates out of Little Bay. Laura, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Also, we have Brian Giannacco of the Virgin Oyster Company, also in Little Bay. Thanks for making the drive.
Thank you.
As I suppose Laura drove is what I hear.
That's correct.
And joining us by phone is Dr. Alex LaFerriere, of the director of the Coastal and Marine Programs for the New Hampshire chapter of the Nature Conservancy. Alex, I hear you got snowed in.
I did get snowed in, but thank you for having me on the show.
Thanks for making the call. All right, so thanks everyone for being here. So why don't we just start with sort of the 30,000 foot view, the history of oysters in the Great Bay. They were once so abundant they were considered a poor man's food. Now they're fairly uncommon, somewhat expensive. Laura and Brian, I'd like to start with the two of you. When did you first eat an oyster and get excited about this?
Well, I'm sort of a rare breed here. I started eating them when I started farming them. I stopped eating seafood when I was six. I stopped liking it, and I never went back to it until 2012 when I started raising oysters, and I decided I had to try them. And now I love them.
Yeah. And yourself, Brian?
Probably when I moved back from Maine, I worked for a fish hatchery in Portsmouth, and those guys were all about seafood and understanding seafood, so they kind of took me out, and I'd never had sushi or oysters, and they were just piled it on, and luckily I took to it.
Well, it's just funny because I think it's not the type of food that you tend to eat from childhood anymore, and so both of you, it wasn't until later in your life.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, I didn't eat it till I started farming it. Seafood, I try to eat. I try to like it. It just never connected with me. But knowing how important and special oysters are, not only to the environment, to our food, they're tons full of protein and everything. I found them a valuable part of my diet now.
So, Alex, if we were to have visited the Great Bay, say, 100 or 200 or even 500 years ago, what would we have seen? How abundant were the oysters in the Great Bay, more than a century ago?
Yeah, so historically, the Great Bay was covered in oysters. About 90% were natural native oyster beds. And the old-timers say that you could walk across on the oyster beds. They were that dense. So functioning, people were harvesting, they were taking them out by the boatloads. That is not the case now, but that was the historical prevalence.
So what exactly happened? When did the numbers start to decline, Alex?
Right, so about in the 70s and 80s, we had a lot of over-historical harvest. The harvest now is pretty low. It's recreational harvest. And then that was exacerbated by heavy things coming into the system. So environmental stressors, excess nutrients coming into the system and contaminants. And then also in the 80s, MSX and Dermo, two diseases started hitting our oysters here. And so they only can grow until about 5 or 6 years old. So the combination of all of those events has kind of wiped out the population to about 10%. So we have 6 native oyster beds within the Great Bay system right now. Some of them are declining. Others of them are growing. The lamprey is the oyster that's in the Lamprey River is growing, and so is the one in the Piscataqua. The one in the Oyster River is not doing quite as well.
So the thing that I find remarkable about this story is that this is something that happened in our lifetimes. I mean, if you were born in the 80s, there were, 25 million oysters in the Great Bay when you were born, and today there's somewhere closer to 2 million.
Right, right. It is kind of amazing that that's happened, and we're hoping through our work at the Nature Conservancy in coordination with the University of New Hampshire Jackson Lab and Dr. Grizzle, we're hoping that we can restore some of these native beds. So we do oyster restoration adjacent to the native beds in the hopes of creating a conductivity of oyster roots. So hopefully we can see this flip around in our lifetime or even sooner in a couple decades where we can restore the oysters to the system. Because oysters bring all these ecosystem services. So they're really, really good at pumping water. An adult oyster in our system can pump 30 gallons of water a day, which is kind of remarkable. And with that, they're taking out all the excess nitrogen and nutrients, and they also create all this habitat for juvenile fish and invertebrates. So they're really important to the oyster reefs and the system. It just helps the entire system. It can even help eelgrass get a foothold. So as the oysters are filtering, and making the water clearer, that allows eelgrass to potentially come back and be regenerative.
So Brian, tell me, in your experience as an oyster aquaculturist and someone who knows the bivalve intimately, what is it about the Great Bay that makes it a good place to grow oysters?
It's a unique bay because of the seven rivers that come into the bay. Farm sites, even though they're close to each other, can often have a very different flavored oyster depending on where that farm is located in relation to a river. We have a site that's near the Bellamy River, and those oysters tend to have a lower salinity and they have a more earthy tone, whereas our site that's further up the river has a saltier oyster, and they just grow differently. So that's fairly unique. We also have unique challenges with huge tides and strong currents, which can also be good and bad.
And Laura, what are you looking for more generally, broadly, when it comes to a place to grow an oyster? Obviously, it has to be salt water. Obviously, it's brackish, actually, right?
Right, right. It is brackish. Part of what I looked for a site was accessibility to the site. If I had to, I was started on my sister's site, I should say, which is a little bit up the bay from where I am now, and I always had to get there by boat. And there wasn't an easy place for me to land with my oysters, to haul them into my truck, to for a cooler, things like that. So when I ultimately found my new site, which is about 6 years ago, I looked for a place that was more easily accessible without a boat. Like, I'm trying to be as minimally invasive as humanly possible. So I actually kayaked my site. And I drag all the oysters back in on the kayaks and haul them up to my truck. It's not 100% ideal, but when I was looking for a site, I wanted a space that I was able to access without interfering with recreation, without interfering with anything that was really happening else in the bay that I would affect negatively. So I feel like my farm's in a space that can only have a positive impact.
Hmm. And for the two of you, I don't know if anyone's got a story that leaps to mind, but we heard a bit about that, the history of what oysters used to be like on the Great Bay. And now that you've been farming on the Great Bay for a while, I imagine you've encountered some of those stories yourself, that you've come across people who have some memory of what things used to be like. Is that the case? Are there still folks sort of talking about the old days of what the oyster reefs used to look like?
Oh, yeah. I think, we run into people at the docks all the time who, see us coming in and realize who we are or what we do. And they spin old yarns quite a bit about when they were younger and used to go up the bay and they could rake, six bushels in an hour or whatever. And it's good to hear people that still remember it and have an appreciation for them.
I also get folks that come in and they say, where are the clam beds? Where are the oyster beds? Where are you? Where did you get those? And I said, well, I farm them. And they almost seem like mad. Well, they used to be out here. Why can't I find them? Where are they now? And I always say, well, I'm not really 100% sure where all the clam beds are, but, go talk to your officials or whatever. But they seem to be bummed out because there used to be so many when they were kids.
Yeah. This is The Exchange on NHPR. We're talking about oysters in the Great Bay, oyster aquaculture, oyster reef restoration, and oysters as a way to clean up the water. And we want to hear from you on this snowy Monday. You can email us at exchange at nhpr.org, or you can give us a call as well, 1-800-892-6477. Have you had any experiences with oyster aquaculture? Have you do you remember the days when you yourself were able to go out and harvest oysters? So Laura, maybe we could do oyster farming 101. If I wanted to start a farm tomorrow, how does it work? What does it take to start one?
Well, the first thing you have to do is find a site, and then you have to apply through New Hampshire Fish and Game, and the application process, you need to really fill out some detailed information about what you want to have on your site, if you're using gear, if you're spreading oysters on the bottom, what you plan to do very specifically. Tide comes into it quite a bit, so you have to know the depth of your farm at sort of a mean low tide. Is anything going to be exposed? Is everything going to be underwater? And then you have to also notify a ton of different state agencies to let them know where you're going and what you plan on doing in case you interfere with anything that they have going on in there. Plus all the abutters nearby to make sure that they don't have a problem with it. So any sort of homeowners that you can see or that might be affected by your site. That's all sort of just the very beginning. So you sort of have to know how you want to farm the oysters as well before you even get going. If you plan on using gear, what your site is like, is it super muddy, is it super silty? What works best in that site.
So it sounds like there are a lot of different ways to do it. There's gear choices to be made. There are bags, there are mm-hmm. cages, there are lines, mm-hmm. And they all have their pluses and minuses.
Yeah, and I think some of the farms, mine included, will use several different gears. So you can use a tray where you just lift a lid and the oysters are sort of free within that tray. You close the lid up and keep it from predators. There's bag and rack system where you put them in a bag, which is a smaller mesh size, and you clean them until they grow into a larger oyster, and you put them in a larger mesh size, and you continue going up in the chain until you're ready to harvest them. At a certain size, you can also spread them out over the ground, and Brian actually does a lot more of that than I do. It's more easily for predators to get to them at a certain size, but they also grow beautifully on the ground if you have the right site. There's also floating gear, and for a long time, we weren't allowed to use that, so I don't know much about anybody that's actually using it, but I know I do not, so I try to stay underwater.
So, Brian, if one were to boat past your oyster farm tomorrow, what would they see? Just buoys?
It depends on the farm. Our sites are limited by the permit as to what we can do on that site. At a low tide, a very low tide on our main farm, they would actually see the rack and bags of oysters, kind of these long, if you can imagine, rows of black mesh bags that are covered in seaweed, so it kind of looks like a line of seaweed on the close to the shorelines that are parallel to the shorelines and about 3 feet apart. But most of our sites that have cages, the cages don't show unless it's a minus tide. And then where we bottom seed, if you drifted over the farm, you would see sand until you got to the oysters, and then you would see seaweed because oysters grow seaweed when they're on the bottom. In fact, if the seaweed gets too big on the oysters, it sails them off the site, which is not good. And generally it's a lot of toggles to let us know where things are, and there are corner markers that say farm that are yellow and have reflective tape on them that allow boaters to know where we're working.
Laura mentioned predators. What eats oysters?
Well, our worst predator we see on our farm is actually a small snail called an oyster drill, and it'll drill about a pencil lead sized hole in any sized oyster, and they can be quite a nuisance. But there's crabs if the oysters are smaller. Typically, the bags protect them from those predators, but snails can get into the bags.
And where do you get oysters? I mean, do you just go to your local Agway and buy a bag of oyster seeds?
Nice.
Bag of seeds, yes. No, we get them from a hatchery. Most of us get our oyster seed from Maine. There's a couple hatcheries in Maine. There's a couple hatcheries in Massachusetts. In the hatcheries, they spawn the oysters and set them so that they're individual oysters. And then we buy them. Some people buy them at a quarter inch, so like your fingernail, but we get ours at 1 millimeter. So if you shook out your pepper shaker on the counter, that's how our oysters show up.
So then you have to grow them from that size to a size that's marketable. So what does that process look like?
We actually start our oysters in a floating nursery. It's actually a dock, and it's powered with a pump. And the oysters sit in a silo where the water's pulled through, and these oysters are filter feeding off the water. So they're kind of just bouncing around slowly in the silo. And after about a month, they'll grow from that 1 millimeter to about a quarter inch. And then we can move them to a bigger mesh bag and move them out onto the farm.
And Laura, are you using the same system?
I did for years, but I found for my farm it works best to buy them to go straight out onto the farm. So I usually purchase them around anywhere from 6 millimeters to 13 millimeters and just put them right out there and stay out there.
So it sounds a lot like in the regular farming industry, you've got nurseries that yep. farmers are buying their starts from. It sounds very
yep,
similar in
exactly.
that regard.
Mm-hmm.
And when is the farming season? When are you doing the work? I imagine it doesn't stop for the winter the way that regular farming does.
It does stop for the winter for some of us. Some of us stay out there for the whole winter. We actually were out on the water yesterday to harvest before this storm.
He says we. He means he. I do not. When my oysters tend to take a little nap in the winter, they're still alive out there and they're still trying to eat and get oxygen from the water a tiny bit, but they basically snooze until the water gets warm again. So usually in April, I head back out there. I start moving the cages, checking on everything. And then May-ish starts to become more and more food in the water, and they start to eat and grow. And then they slow down now-ish.
Yeah, they're already slowing down. The waters are below 40 degrees. They actually almost hibernate for the winter out there. And we pull our boats usually the first of the year, sometime in January, because we try to, get oysters on the menu for the holidays, and then the ice is the biggest concern. Ice is a hazard to us. It's a hazard to the gear and the boats, so we want to get out before the ice comes in.
I have a very small farm, so I tend to sell out of my larger oysters anywhere from September to early December. So I sold out this year in the middle of October, cleaned up the farm, and I was done about a month ago.
So, Alex, I want to throw this question to you. If oysters are filter feeders and indeed are eating whatever's in the water, should we be concerned about contaminants? What are you getting if you're eating something that's submerged in water that's not super clean?
Well, think about an oyster when it's filtering out water. It will use the nutrients, the excess nutrients, nitrogen. Which may not be good for us, or excess nitrogen is not necessarily good for eelgrass, for example, but it will assimilate it in its tissue, and it will use it, and it will also denitrify. It can take the nitrogen and turn it inert so that it's a good nitrogen. And so when we, by the time we eat that oyster, it's part of its, assimilated, and so it's not bad for us. So it's not bad for them, and it's not bad for us. And in terms of contaminants, oysters don't bioaccumulate like some other shellfish, and we have very low level of contamination in the Great Bay. So it's more about excess nutrients, so nitrogen and phosphorus and things like that.
So Alex mentioned nitrogen, which for years was the bête noire of the Great Bay, still is to that effect. But so to be clear here, this is a nutrient; it's not a contaminant. And so the fact that they clean nitrogen out of the water doesn't mean that they're getting something dirty in their flesh.
That's right. If they utilize it, we utilize nitrogen in our system. They utilize it, and they can take it out of the water. They can exchange it and make it inert, and so it's good for them and good for us.
Brian, you had something to say?
Well, in terms of contaminants, we have pretty strict protocols for harvesting. We actually have to call into DES to ensure that there haven't been any concerns, issues with a waste treatment plant or any other spills, an oil spill or something in the bay. DES monitors the water, and there's classifications of water. The water has to be classified as safe for harvesting. So it's actually monitored in that fashion too.
So if you were to eat an oyster that had gotten some sort of harmful coliform in it, you could in fact get sick. And so that's why these closures exist.
That's correct.
Right. All right. So you are listening to The Exchange on NHPR. I am Sam Evans-Brown. When we get back, we will crack open the efforts to bring more oysters back to the Great Bay, both through the restoration of natural reefs and through aquaculture, and what those efforts mean for the future of the estuary. Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from UR subscribers and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Sam Evans-Brown, in for Laura Kanoi. Today, all about oysters. The number for you to join our conversation is 1-800-892-6477. You can email us at exchange@nhpr.org. You can comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Today, our guests are Laura Brown of Fox Point Oysters on the Great Bay, Brian Giannacco of Virgin Oyster Company, also in Little Bay, and Alex LaFerriere, director of the Coastal and Marine Program for the New Hampshire chapter of the Nature Conservancy. Alex, I want to jump back to you here for a second. We have heard the term keystone species applied to oysters in the past. So what is it exactly about them that makes them such an important part of a healthy estuary system?
Yeah, sure. So keystone species is a great term for an oyster. They're also an ecosystem engineer. So they play a pretty critical role in kind of two highways. One is in water quality and water filtration, so removing excess nutrients and nitrogen from the system. And then the other is they create this amazing kind of dynamic 3D structure that is habitat for juvenile fish and vertebrates. So you think about, like, when you eat an oyster on the half shell, it's like perfectly shaped. Laura and Brian do a great job of like making their oysters look beautiful. But when oysters are growing in the wild, they just grow on top of each other. And so there's all these nooks and crannies. So if you're, you know, a juvenile fish that needs a home and needs to hide and needs to find somewhere to eat, it's a great place to grow up. And so these, you know, when we lose oysters from the system, we lose all that critical habitat. So 70% of all commercial fisheries spend part of their life cycle in an estuary. And so estuaries are really, really important, not just for even in New Hampshire, but also the whole Gulf of Maine. So we have a number of estuaries in New England, and the Great Bay is a really good structure system that supports the Gulf of Maine. And that's why we're trying to restore these oysteries. It's our goals are twofold, is to improve water quality, but also to replace some of this habitat that has been lost.
I'm curious, Alex, when it comes to cleaning up the water, when it comes to the actual act of filtering the water through the bodies of these filter feeders, is there any reason to suspect that natural reef restoration would be better than having millions of oysters in aquaculture systems? I mean, does a farmed oyster clean the water as well as a wild one or not?
A farmed oyster cleans the water just as well as a native one. Absolutely. So I think with aquaculture, there's a lot of ecosystem services that come from aquaculture. So if you think about it, restorative aquaculture, if a farm is sited in a place that needs water cleanup, or it also creates the structure for this habitat as well. So restorative aquaculture is a way that can help our estuary as well.
So, Laura, I'm curious to know, how many oyster farms are there in, and I keep saying Great Bay, but really it's in the Little Bay, right, which is a sort of subset of the Great Bay. It's farther up the bay toward the Piscataqua River. But how many farms are there in Little Bay right now?
I want to say there's 15-ish. I think about 15 of us. Is that right, Brian?
There's probably 15 farmers. I think there's probably somewhere closer to 30 sites that are currently being farmed, right. And they can be anywhere from half an acre to 4 acres.
And having been out on the water, when we talk about them, they're very small, right? This isn't, you know, rows and rows and rows of. I mean, there are rows of bags and cages, but in my one visit to an oyster farm, it was a pretty contained operation.
Yeah, we're set to a certain space where we can do our operation because we share this space with the public. It might be a 4-acre space, but in the scope of the bay, it's not very big. Yes.
Right.
Yeah, if you point that out to someone and you say, look at that far yellow buoy way over there, it seems far when you're there, but then when you look from, you know, the road or something, it's just a tiny little speck.
So when you mentioned that this is the public spaces, you know, the bay is a public resource, these are public waters. So what are the trade-offs? What are the other uses that that are occurring right now on the Great Bay?
Recreation. It's a lot of recreational fishing, just recreational boating. People like to go out in the summertime. People are still clamming when they can find it and when they can do it. I think that's a little bit limited right now just because of the fewer numbers that there are. That's what I see mostly.
So recreational fishing, and if you were to quantify it, is that mostly folks fishing for themselves, or are we talking charter boats or a little of both?
Mostly just fishing for themselves. I don't think there's any charter boats in the – well, there's some lobster. Small charters, I should say, that are like where someone would take out one or two people to fish.
There's also lobster. There's quite a few lobster people out there.
And are lobster boats and oyster aquaculture, is that occurring in the same types of bottom, or are you really looking for different features?
Most of the oyster farms that I know of, I should speak for myself, mine's on a mudflat. There's really not a lot there. So I'm inside of a mooring field, so boats tend to not go inside mooring fields because there could be rocks, there could be trees, there could be anything there. Right now there's cages. But I find a spot that no one else was using, and I've noticed that most of the lobster folks tend to stay out in the deeper channel. So I'm not affected directly by them.
Yeah, and part of the permitting process is to make sure that we don't have an interaction with another commercial activity. So if there was an area where there was lobster buoys and you tried to site a farm there, more than likely you wouldn't be allowed to.
Hmm. Right, and Alex had mentioned, if you don't mind me jumping in, Alex had mentioned that all the fish and everything that live in the natural oyster reefs, they also come to our sites quite a bit. We have a ton of habitat living there. A couple of years, I've seen squid eggs next to my cages. I didn't know what it was. My sister's a scientist, so I was like, come get this. What is this? Show me what this is. And we have little fish. We have eels. We have everything. There's lobsters jumping out of my cages sometimes. It's created quite the habitat over there.
Which actually leads to another point, which is Little Bay used to be full of eelgrass. Most of the eelgrass has receded thanks to environmental pressures, and oyster aquaculture can't be put on top of eelgrass, is what I'm told.
That's correct. Yeah, Fish and Game sends a diver down to check the sites that we want to be on, and if they find any eelgrass, we have to either choose a new site, change the location, or shrink it or something.
So, Brian, you were recently denied a permit when you asked to expand your operation out into a new area. There was some concern about the use of floating cages, I understand. So tell me about that process and what the concerns of the other users and abutters were.
Sure. Well, when you apply, one of the big parts of an application is having a public hearing and speaking with abutters and the public. That particular site, we had put down a couple different types of growing, and one of the things we decided to try in the permit to see if it would be acceptable was a small area of floating gear, so some floating cages. But at the public hearing, there was quite an outcry that it would be an issue for people sailing in that area. And right in the public hearing, we basically said, you know, all right, that's fine. This is why we have public hearings, and we took it out of the permit. The application ended up being denied, which I was surprised at, but it is an area that's actively used by recreational activities. And so I think going forward, it's just more contact with neighbors and trying to figure out a way that we can work together. In the past, we've had people come out and speak against a permit, and when we sat down with them individually, we were able to come to an agreement, either making the site smaller or making an adjustment to the type of gear, or and been able to work past it and go forward.
Alex, I know that in the past, because of the known water quality benefits of oyster aquaculture, the Nature Conservancy has had an effort to educate shore landowners about those benefits, and has had them growing their own oysters on strings at the end of their docks. Is that effort still underway? And what have you found in terms of trying to get the locals on board with this idea?
Yeah, great. We do have that well underway. That is called our Oyster Conservation Program. So as part of our reef restoration, we engaged with stakeholders to help us raise oysters, and they collect data. So we have 18 sites in New Hampshire. this last year. And so that's about 200 people. That's often a family event. So they get a cage of a sat on shells, so baby oysters called a sat, and they raise that cage of oysters all summer, so about 10 weeks, and they take data. So they measure them, see how well they're growing. They also have a separate bag where they collect natural sat or natural baby oysters that will settle on their cage. And what it does is we collect all the information from all around the estuary, and we can look at where they grow really well, where they survive the best, where there's natural recruitment of oysters coming into the system, and that will help us decide where we should do reef restoration. And then all the oysters that they raise at the end of the summer, we collect them. We do another round of measurements. It's called Stat Counting Week, and it's a volunteer event, and it's a really good time. And all of our OCs will then put their oysters on the actual site. So it's a really good program, and we obviously take the community to do reef restoration, and our OCs are really passionate about growing oysters, and they're very educated and very into it. It's a really cool program.
This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Today, restorative aquaculture on the half shell. Today, we're talking about the effort to boost the population of oysters in the Great Bay, both through means natural and aquacultural. We want your oyster questions. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. You can call in 1-800-892-6477. Alex, I'm just going to recap a little of what you said. We're missing a little bit out from your line out there in the snowstorm. Sounds like you're doing not just outreach to landowners, but trying to collect data as well from the oysters that they're growing to get an idea of where you might best target your restoration efforts. Maybe we could use that to jump off, and we can talk about this reef restoration effort that you are in the midst of right now. Can you give us the 30,000 foot view? What exactly does it look like to try to restore a natural reef? How do you do it?
Right. So we've been doing reef restoration in coordination with the University of New Hampshire, Ray Grizzle and Kristen Ward at the Jackson Labs since 2009. And we started small at about a quarter of an acre, and we've moved up and restored about a 5-acre footprint. So what we do is we truck up clamshells from Rhode Island, and we also have the Coastal Conservation Association collect oyster shells from the restaurants, and we put that shell, and it's a big operation. It's about 30 dump trucks. Big barges, and we work with Riverside and Pickering, and we barge that up to the restoration site. And then we put that down as a reef base, and we put it down in piles. And that reef base is there. It's now mud, and then we put the reef, we call it the reef, we put the reef in, we put the shell in. And so now the native oysters that are reproducing and their larvae are out in the water. When they're ready to settle, they actually have something to settle on, whereas before it was not. And then at the same time, we raise oysters or sat on shell at the Jackson Lab over the course of the summer. So we set, we import larvae from a hatchery in Maine, Muskonga Bay, and then we set it on that oyster shell in cages, and then we grow them in raft culture at the lab, and we deploy them out on that shell that we put in. And this year, we're doing some cool things with some of our growers. So we're working with Laura on the show, and also Kristen Ward from Choice Oysters and Tim Henry from Bay Oysters, where we're working on growing oysters in a biodegradable substrate. So we're trying to better and make more oysters. They live longer. We're growing oysters at the lab. But then we're also working with these growers. I mean, it's like working, with a fisherman. It's just, you want to know where the fish are, where are the fishermen. And so the growers are really good at growing oysters. And we grew about 10,000 oysters with the growers this summer, and then we deployed them in this, like, coconut fiber biodegradable bag onto the reef.
And so how do we know that those efforts are working and that the wild oysters that you're trying to grow are, in fact, surviving and thriving? Or is there a sort of follow-up study to check in to see how many are out there?
Yeah. So what we do is we do monitoring every year in the fall and then again in the spring. So, again, Dr. Gergel at the University of New Hampshire, we work with him and also other scientists to look at what the oysters are there, how much they've grown, what the percent survival is. And then this year we just started adding some habitat surveys. So we went out and we did some snorkel surveys to see what other kind of animals and or algae are there on the reef. So is it providing that habitat? And then we also correlate it with the water quality metrics that are happening within Great Bay. So the nitrogen is going down, and that's for a lot of different efforts, but the reef restoration is helping that effort as well.
We're going to go to a caller now. We're going to talk to Kevin up in Snowville. Kevin, you're on the exchange. What would you like to hear?
Hi. I'd just like to say that I own a small restaurant up in just south of Conway in Snowville, Snow Village Inn. And my partner and I, Jen, we've always loved oysters. We always traveled over to the Maine coast. But one day we were driving back and we said, well, there's no oysters in the Mount Washington Valley. We should be introducing them to people up here. So we started getting oysters about 7 years ago. And the response has been phenomenal. We did mostly 5 days a week we do oysters, and on Thursdays, in order to get new people in, what we do is we do have what we call an oyster orgy, and we discount our oysters significantly and try and introduce it to new people.
And Kevin, you found that they're a hit. I understand.
Oh, they're a big hit. I mean, we have people that always loved oysters. We're like phenomenal if they come in. We have some people that come in and they'll pre-order 3 dozen oysters when they make their reservation for dinner. So it's been a real good hit for us. And it's also, we're trying to get down to New Hampshire to get some of the Bay oysters. Most of our oysters are coming out of Maine and Massachusetts, but we've tried a few of them out there. They are really good. It's just that it's not as easy for us to get them.
So, Brian, to that question, how far can you ship a fresh oyster, and how come you're not in the Mount Washington Valley?
I'll have a call with my distributor after this. We actually we deliver locally right off the farm to restaurants in Portsmouth, but we have a distributor here in the state that does most of our regional deliveries, and mostly in New Hampshire, actually. A majority of our product stays in the state.
And is there a reason that it has to be strictly a local food, or can they go much farther?
Oh, no. My distributor sent oysters to Japan and China, so they can go anywhere.
So they can make it to the Mount Washington Valley.
Well, I would ask Kevin where he's getting the oysters from, if he's picking them up or if he has a distributor that delivers them, and have them call us and ask us to bring them oysters. We have a lot of restaurants that say, oh, can you bring 100? Or can you bring 200? And if it's a half-hour drive, it kills us, and the price goes way up, and nobody wants that. So if they can find our local distributors, I'm sure they'd be happy to drive them up to them.
Hmm. And so we touched on this a little bit in the initial conversation, but also Kevin, I think, alluded to this, but oysters from different places have different flavors. The so-called miroir, as opposed to terroir, is the term I'm told I'm supposed to use. Can we talk about that a little bit? What are the different types of oyster flavors one might encounter?
It really depends on the bay. I mean, as I said earlier, we have one that we grow on the bottom, and it's kind of a muddy substrate, and they tend to be more earthy with not as much salt. Salty is a big one. If you get an oyster that's grown out in straight seawater, it's going to be very salty. You're going to get a real deep salt flavor. But it can vary widely. Oysters from the West Coast kind of have a melony flavor or almost a cucumber flavor to the meats, very different than the East Coast oyster.
Sometimes you'll taste a little mineral too, and sometimes you can see the difference inside the oyster. You might see more of a green or a brown depending on what they're eating.
Hmm. You are listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. When we come back, what does the future hold for wild and farmed bivalves in the Great Bay? What will the Great Bay look like 50 years from now? That's after a short break.
Giving Tuesday is a chance for you to celebrate the organizations that benefit your community by giving back. Hi, I'm Laura Kanoy, host of The Exchange. And when you donate to NHPR, you can extend your generosity by giving meals to the New Hampshire Food Bank at the same time. Contribute $10 a month and pay forward your thank you gift. Instead of choosing a mug, choose to give 10 meals to the food bank. Give today at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Sam Evans Brown, in for Laura Kanoy. Today we're talking about oyster aquaculture and oyster reef restoration in the Great Bay. The number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 1-800-892-6477. The email address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on social media as well. We're on Facebook at NHPR Exchange. Our guests for the hour are Laura Brown and Brian Giannacco, two oyster farmers out in the Little Bay, and Dr. Alex LaFerriere of the Nature Conservancy. Alex, one more question for you here about the effort to restore natural reefs out in the Great Bay. Historically, these twin diseases that hit the oyster reefs in the 80s and 90s were a big reason that we lost so many of the natural reefs. There was dermo, which is a disease that came up from warmer waters, and MSX, which I think was supposedly introduced from Pacific oysters. So how do we know that if we seed new oysters back in the bay, that they won't just be wiped out by disease again?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we have this advantage that when we are rearing or raising oysters on land, we import larvae, and that larvae or the baby oyster is disease resistant. It doesn't mean that it will not be susceptible to disease at some point. It could be, but it is more resistant. And so when we put them out and they're growing, they have kind of that foothold. So we're hoping that they will live longer because they're disease resistant. One thing that's kind of nice as well, going back to the aquaculture, is that most of our growers, although I don't think all of them, but most of the growers that are producing oysters, they have oysters that are reproducing, and so their oysters are also disease resistant. So those larvae are getting into the water column and disease resistant. And we have started a program where we have been experimenting with the ugly. So an oyster that is ugly or it's not market, it's really big, and so we've been using those in reef restoration as an experiment to see if those will live longer. They're really, really, they're already big from the farm. They're disease resistant strain, and we're putting those on the reef to see if their survival will exceed the ones that we're growing at the lab.
And what about climate change? I mean, the science tells us that oceans are absorbing, you know, upwards of 90% of the heat that climate change has trapped in the atmosphere. And in our neck of the woods, the Gulf of Maine is warming faster than 99% of the world's oceans. So what does that mean for oysters going forward? Do they need cold water? What is their range?
So that's a great question, too. So there's some benefits with oysters. So back to your question about the range, they can do pretty well in warm water. But one thing that they're susceptible to is ocean acidification. So as our water's warm, they become more acidic, and the shell of the oyster is susceptible to, you know, breaking down if the water gets too acidic. On the other hand, when we put a lot of oyster shell or recycled clam shell or recycled oyster shell into the system, that's buffering the water against ocean acidification. So by doing this reef restoration, we're buffering like the Great Bay, and we're also sequestering the oysters and eelgrass as well, both sequester carbon. So, you know, we hear about how forests sequester carbon. Well, there's the blue carbon, the carbon sink of the Great Bay, and oysters are a key component of that.
And when you say buffering, Alex, what I think you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that the shells are made from calcium, which is basic. And so before the water becomes acidic, it has to sort of combat all the calcium that those shells are putting into the water. Is that right?
That's right. It's helping with the pH. So, yeah, it is actually buffering the system.
So this question of ocean acidification, I know, has become a real tough one for oyster farmers on the West Coast. And I have read stories that some of the hatcheries there have had huge die-offs of their oyster seed because of these sort of acidic water events. And some of them have begun to even move indoors to try to combat that acidification. I'm curious, here on the East Coast, Brian or Laura, have any of those types of effects started to come to the East Coast as well? Or is that still just a West Coast phenomenon? Have you had difficulty getting seed any years because of shortages at the hatcheries?
I know that the hatcheries in Maine have had problems. In fact, there's some that have been doing research and buffering their water coming into the hatchery to protect the larval stages of the oyster. The ocean acidification, it's something that doesn't necessarily affect the larger oysters as much as those larval oysters, which, you know, they're building a shell out of nothing, and if they if the water's acidic, it can easily dissolve that shell, and the animal can't become competent to set.
And so as of yet, you haven't had any trouble getting seed, but you've heard tell that they've had some problems here or there.
There have been failures at hatcheries, and I think that's why they've switched to some of the hatcheries at least buffering their water coming in. It's been a problem.
I'm curious we mentioned the marowar, the taste of the oysters earlier on. Have either of you had wild oysters harvested off of a natural reef? Do we know if there's any difference between the taste between the two wild or cultivated oysters?
I have not.
I've had wild oysters harvested off my farm because they do set there occasionally, and they taste basically the same. But an older oyster that might be out on a reef in another area probably would taste quite different.
How would you know it's a wild oyster if it's in your bags?
Because it's set onto either onto another oyster or a piece of shell. So I know these larval oysters have a swimming stage and they need something to set on. Typically, they're going to set on an oyster shell or another oyster so that they can be close by when they all spawn. But usually you'll find them, they're stuck to a periwinkle shell or something different, and you know this did not come from a hatchery.
So some of the other impacts from climate change that we have been warned about are sort of larger rain events, more runoff. I'm curious if either of you, as in the operation of your farm, have seen those types of impacts from rainstorms, or if there is a big rainstorm, what does that do to your operation?
Well, if we get over an inch and a half of rain, we're shut down from harvesting temporarily until this one very important person at DES goes out and tests the water quality, and he'll test oyster flesh as well and make sure that there haven't been any major spills or anything in the bay that's affecting it. So we've been closed down for quite a while before, and then sometimes it reopens in a matter of 2 or 3 days.
And so the idea of the inch and a half threshold is that there's all sorts of stuff just getting washed off the land into the bay, and that might wind up in the oysters, so they have to make sure it's safe before you can open up again.
Yeah, I think that's a part of it, and also wastewater treatment plants, they're going to get flooded too. So they have to make sure that they haven't had any issues cycling that water through.
This is the combined sewer overflows that folks have talked about, because our sewer pipes and our stormwater pipes are combined. And so when you get a lot of rain,
yes,
it all goes into the wastewater plant, yes, and it might get overwhelmed.
Yep.
That's correct. And typically they test the water and we open right back up. But as the weather changes and we have more rain events, especially back-to-back heavy rain events, like the month of, what was it, May this year?
Yeah.
We had 22 days of rain. It's very hard to get the bay to open back up again,
because
every 3 days you have a rain event. It's like, we're open, oh, we're closed.
And so what does that do? I mean, how did your business operate in the month of May if you weren't allowed to? I mean, are you just sort of doing other stuff?
It's farming. Yeah, you're working on the farm, but, you know, you're also stomping your feet on the boat.
There's never a down day on the farm. You can work all the time without ever selling an oyster, just trying to keep them clean and happy and grow them as fast as you possibly can in the healthiest conditions. So even if you're not harvesting, you're still working. You're just not making any money.
Right. All the work, just none of the money-making part of the work.
Yep.
So I guess if we were to say, what does success look like on the Great Bay? What does it look like when we say, you know, we've done it and we've cleaned up the bay? In terms of aquaculture, from the two of you as folks who are doing the work, what would a successful aquaculture industry in the Great Bay look like?
Brian?
I think it's where companies are becoming economically viable. We're all still small and growing and learning. My joke is we learn a new way to kill oysters every year. We've had some really bad winters. I mean, ice in the winter destroys stuff, and you get these super low tides, things freeze. But it's going to be where we hit the threshold where we can produce enough oysters to employ people and keep things running, and I think that's really where everybody wants to be, and we're all working towards it. It's a really tight community.
I think also part of what's so nice about it right now, and this just might because I have a small farm and that's what I want to keep, is that you really don't know that there are oyster farms out there unless you see someone standing kind of in the middle of the water doing something and someone kayaks over and says, "What are you doing?" And when you say, "Oh, I have an oyster farm here," they're like, "Really? I kayak by here every day. I had no idea." And I like how minimally invasive it is right now. And I think that helps the community be a little more settled about it, too, knowing that there's not these huge ships going out and processing tons and tons of things that are hurting the bay. What we're doing only helps the bay. So I think keeping it somewhat small, but still hopefully being able to make a living at it would be really helpful.
Well, and that's the question. Is it something like, are you making a living or is this
no.
still...
Is it not... I have a few other jobs, but it's a sort of like a long reach. It's out there. But like Brian said, one winter, I think I lost 80% to 90% of 3 years worth of oysters. You put them in new each year. It's a 2 to 3 year growing cycle. So if I lose half of them this year, 3 years from now, I'm going to see this effect. Or if I double my oyster stock this year, I'm not going to see that for another 2 or 3 years. So it's definitely a long game. And I'm in it for the long game, and I think I can definitely make a living doing it. And like Brian said, I figured out a lot of ways to kill him, but I'm also figuring out a lot of ways to keep him alive.
Is this a full-time job for you, Brian?
It is for about 9 months of the year. We are full-time on the water. This summer I had two part-time employees working for me, both graduates of UNH that had been in the Marine or the science program and looking for jobs in the field. And there's not a lot of them around, so that was... pretty wonderful, and they both are really great workers. And then when we have 3 months off, we actually build a lot of the equipment we use on the farm. It's all custom made. And in the winter, we build equipment for other farmers who have seen it and said, "Wow, can I get one of those?" So we have a little business doing that too.
And in terms of the sort of natural limits to the size of, I think, Laura, you kind of alluded to this here, to what degree is the fact that Little Bay is little sort of a natural limiter on how big aquaculture can be?
Well, right now we're limited to a certain area, and I think that's a controllable area and a manageable area for people like DES who's going out and testing water quality. You can't just go all over the place and test it. So we've been limited to one small space, but different spaces open up. But they're all, most of them have a different condition. So it's always called conditionally approved. You know, some can't harvest in the summer. Some can't harvest in the winter. Sometimes the rivers will open up and you can go deeper in there and apply for a site like Brian had done. So there is room for expansion. But, you know, we have to be a certain distance from each other. And unless you're doing oysters on this long line system where you're hauling them up onto a boat, there's, you know, less and less mud flats because we're, you know, we've taken over quite a few of these unused spaces. So I don't know how big it can get, but I know there is some room for sure.
Hmm. Alex, I'm curious from your perspective, when we talk about the reef restoration efforts, which obviously are taking place in Great Bay, which has a little more space, you said you're looking at 5 acres or so that you've restored now. What would a successful reef restoration look like in the long scale?
Which I think, so we've restored in about a 28-acre footprint so far, but I think what success is functioning is in a great place with a better shell there, but that there's oysters living and pumping water and filtering water, and that there's, algae and juvenile fish and invertebrates, and it's providing that habitat. So that's what I mean about functioning system, and that it's also resilient and that it's self-sustaining. So that the water quality has improved enough and the habitat's improved enough where there is enough habitat there that it can be resilient to these stressors that we are seeing, and we are going to see more with climate change impacts and more rain events. So I think that's what success is like, is that we can get it, if we can help the estuary by doing reef restoration to get it to a place that it's functioning, and then it can be resilient to stressors down the road.
So essentially, you're trying to bring back the system that existed before the 80s and 90s, if I'm getting that right, a system that keeps itself going.
Yeah, that's right. And I think we need to be thoughtful and creative and dynamic about how we do that. And one of the things is working with the oyster growers, which we're doing. We're just starting to do it. It's been fantastic and And then our other stakeholders, a lot of people are really passionate about Great Bay, and they want to see the system come back and be resilient. And, our Oyster Conservationist Program, it really does take a whole community to get oysters and get the bay back on track. And I think our stakeholders are really engaged, and it's been fun to work with them in restoring the bay.
I want to thank our guests for being on the program today. Laura Brown of Fox Point Oysters, operating out of Little Bay. Laura, thanks for making the drive.
Thank you so much.
Brian Giannacco of the Virgin Oyster Company, also in Little Bay. Thanks for being here, Brian.
Thank you.
And Dr. Alex LaFerriere, the director of the Coastal and Marine Programs for the New Hampshire chapter of the Nature Conservancy. Alex, thanks for making time for us this morning.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
That's it for today. Remember, the conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.